Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming Outlander series or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 32 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, some announcements this week. There were a few. It was kind of quiet. They were all on location, which would explain the latter part of the week when we got some shots from a bunch of the actors actually posting some location pictures, which were actually quite stunning. It looks like Katrina was involved in that. Matt B. Roberts sent some. And then the Gaelic, we'll just call him Adam.
Adam is the anglicized name.
Anyway, he also provided some rather stunning shots. They're all on their, I think on their Twitter accounts, you can see them. From Stars officially, we started off the week with a shot of Jamie in his 18th century regalia, looking quite stunning. Obviously, it's raining because he's under a very modern umbrella.
Very pink umbrella.
Is it? I think it's red, but I think just the way the light's hitting it does kind of look kind of magenta.
It's either red and black or red and navy or pink or navy.
I can't imagine anyone handing Jamie Fraser a pink umbrella.
Well, he's off duty, so it's Sam, but he's definitely in character.
April Fool's Day was
quite the day.
It was eventful. It started off by us being Randall rolled with them promising. I mean, we should have known better. Trying to tell us we're going to get some, you know, close up shots of, you know, get to know him a little more. And then it was just a picture of
Randall,
Blackjack Randall, with the name flashing upon it as Randall rolled, which harkens back to when they started Rick rolling a few years ago with the Rick Astley song, which was really funny. But then they made it up to us by providing us with a smoldering shot of our Jamie Fraser in the hay with a horse in the background and a shot of this thigh.
Just a little bit. And I don't know if I read it on Twitter or on Facebook, probably Twitter, I don't know. People were asking, is this still pretty much all of the shots we've seen were from early on in the first four episodes, because that's what we know they have finished. And this looks like it is as well, because it looks like some kind of bandage around his neck or shoulder area, the light color fabric that's definitely not part of a shirt. So that was what I had seen asked.
I feel like you could almost track it by his hair length,
because
his hair is getting longer as the shoot progresses, as it should. Because that's, you know, part of the plot. We also received another shot from Outlander Stars. They put this on their Twitter. And it's kind of a woodsy shot that's like sort of ruins that are kind of overgrown with ivy.
Very pretty.
It's really pretty. I wonder what that used to be. Definitely two big walls.
And part of a third. Because this is thicker than that one. Which you cannot see what I'm pointing to.
But it's still a stunning shot. They also provided another guess what this is shot. And when it first came up, everyone just noticed the basket portion of it and immediately said, oh, I think it's a picnic basket.
Except I said it was either a picnic or puppies.
Yeah. And
which I think is the best thing.
I didn't post it, but when I did look at it, I said, that looks like yarn.
I thought puppies, but
I thought yarn, because it was all kind of, you know, darkly colored. I was like, well, it's either a picnic or it's yarn, but my gut instinct was initially yarn, and I should have posted it because I was right.
It was not puppies.
It was not puppies.
No. That would have been great, though. Little tiny Jaspers, little itty bitty baby Jaspers in a basket? Come on now. That's the best thing ever.
Then it would have been bad to have little needles poking out of all of them, because those are obvious knitting needles.
Actually, kittens would have been better. But kittens wouldn't stay as still as puppies, I don't think.
It depends on how young they are.
They're that young. They don't need to be away from their mom.
Their eyes are shut. They pretty much stay still.
That's true.
And we also received a beautiful shot of Katrina this week. Looks like the makeup artist is putting on her makeup.
No, her patina.
Call it what you like.
I'm sorry. I thought it was cute.
It's cute. But I think this is probably one of my favorite stills they've released of her. Mm-hmm. I think she looks literally stunning in this picture.
I know it's Katrina, but it's so Claire. I mean, that's the whole point. But when it is the costume too, don't get me wrong, it's the hair, but it's, I don't know if it's just certain people. It definitely is the hair and makeup, and it's the costume as well, but certain people are just such chameleons, mm-hmm. and she's one of them.
That about wraps up our announcements this week, which is good, because we have a lot going on. This week, we have been joined by a very special guest.
James Morrison.
From the National Capital Tartan Day Committee.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, I can't believe I remembered all of that.
So sit back and enjoy our Tartan Day special interview.
We'd like to welcome James Morrison, Secretary of the National Capital Tartan Day Committee, to the Outlander podcast.
Yay!
Mr. Morrison, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm honored to do this.
How did you get involved with the National Capital Tartan Day Committee?
Well, I can give you a long answer, and let me start with, we have been actually celebrating National Tartan Day for about 17 years now. It started really in 1997 when I was a member of another organization in Northern Virginia called the Clans of Scotland. One of our members was a friend of Senator Trent Lott, who has Scottish heritage as a Buchanan, and she got a resolution through recognizing National Tartan Day. And that was a one-year resolution. 1998, there was a permanent resolution through the Senate. And I've been involved with Tartan Day since 1997. I was formerly with the Washington Times, and I was a diplomatic correspondent, so I knew a lot of the embassies, and I had connections with the British embassy. So we got the British embassy to issue a proclamation, and they held cocktail receptions for Tartan Day. And then we moved on. We created the Tartan Day Committee formally in 2002. And in 2005, we had a House resolution passed. And in 2007, President Bush issued a presidential proclamation. And we have proclamations from Washington and Alexandria, the state of Virginia, and the state of Maryland, which sort of covers the area that we represent. And I think one of the greatest accomplishments that we did was by 2001, we got Sean Connery to come to Washington for National Tartan Day. There is a wonderful photograph in 2001 of Trent Lott and Sean Connery in their kilts, and they are proceeding to a ceremony on the west terrace of the Capitol. And we continue to hold ceremonies there, well, actually right up until the great disaster, September 11, 2001. But in one year, Vice President Cheney came out and just sort of wandered through the crowd and shook hands with the flag bearers, the color guards. So it's been a great deal of fun, and we've had some influence here in Washington to get it recognized widely. We've also had the first ministers of Scotland come over quite regularly to celebrate Tartan Day. And I think in 2007, the first minister at the time, who was Henry McLeish, was actually invited to the Oval Office where President Bush wanted to talk to him about Tartan Day. So that's a long answer, but I've been involved with it for a long time.
So what is Tartan Day?
Tartan Day actually is April 6th of every year, and it celebrates the signing on April 6, 1320, in Scotland of the Declaration of Arbroath. That's A-R-B-R-O-A-T-H. And that is often considered Scotland's Declaration of Independence. If you've seen the movie Braveheart, it's all sort of wrapped up into that. Once William Wallace is executed and Robert Bruce takes over, the civil war with England continues to go on. And so finally, on April 6, 1320, the barons of Scotland get together and sign this declaration. It's an appeal to the Pope to tell the Pope to tell the English to stop invading Scotland and to recognize Scotland as an independent country. And there are some similarities in the writings of the Declaration of Arbroath and some of the influence on the Declaration of Independence. They both set forward some basic principles about the responsibility of the government to the people and very basic principles. And it's widely regarded now that Arbroath was an influence on the signers of the Declaration of Independence. And I have something here from a really interesting book by Duncan Bruce called The Mark of the Scots. And of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence, 21 had some Scottish ancestry. And two of them, John Wetherspoon and James Wilson, were actual Scots who had immigrated to the United States and become prominent revolutionaries inside the Declaration of Independence. They had 21 of the 56 signers who had Scottish heritage of some sort. And that's how it all sort of came about. That's what Tartan Day is. And it recognizes, it's a very American holiday as far as we're concerned. It recognized the contribution that Scots and Americans of Scottish heritage have made to the United States. Plus, it's also a great time to wear your kilt and drink some scotch.
Absolutely. So I know you're basically involved in the Capitol, but how do you guys celebrate Tartan Day? What are typical Tartan Day celebrations?
What we're doing on Saturday in Alexandria, I guess I should mention that I live in Alexandria, Virginia, which is just across the Potomac River from Washington, and Alexandria was a town founded by Scots in 1749. There was a Ramsay and a Carlyle who were the original founders of the town. It was named after a fellow named Alexander who was a Scotsman. So we've chosen Alexandria as sort of our place to hold festivities. We'll be doing an open-air festival at right on the Potomac River on Saturday, which is April 5th. And then in the middle of the week, next week, we'll be celebrating Tartan Day at a Capitol Hill reception. And that's where we usually get leaders of both parties coming to raise a glass and salute Tartan Day. And frequently, House Speaker John Boehner is there. Before him, Speaker Nancy Pelosi was there. Senators come over, and it gives everybody a great time to meet and mingle, and people get a chance to meet some members of Congress. So we do two things, really, the festival and the reception at the Capitol. Now, the reception follows a day-long symposium that we also do at the Capitol Visitor Center. And in the past, we've had symposiums on tartans that represent different U.S. states. And this year we're doing some lectures on Scottish heritage and other issues that would be of interest to people who are interested in Scotland. So that's how we do it here.
Now, you described your local celebration.
Yes.
Are there other larger celebrations, not necessarily larger than your own, but equally as maybe as well-known?
Yes.
Or almost as well-known in our country?
I would say the largest one is probably in New York. And they actually have a parade, and they once had 10,000 pipers. This was a Tartan Day that was the September 11th terrorist attack, and this had already been well arranged, and they really couldn't cancel it, so they decided to take Tartan Day and dedicate it to the victims of the World Trade Center attack and the attack on the Pentagon. And every year they've had a parade. They have a fashion show called Dressed to Kilt.
Great.
And Sean Connery is a regular visitor to that as well. And then there are other celebrations throughout the United States, but New York is probably the biggest one. We have tried to have a parade in Washington, but because we come right up against the National Cherry Blossom Festival, it's just impractical for us to try to do anything. So we concentrate on Alexandria, and then we concentrate on the Capitol. I might say that both the House and the Senate have a Scottish caucus because of our efforts, because of the National Tartan Day. So the biggest one's in New York, and we like to think of ourselves as the most important one.
Well, it's a shame you guys hold them all on the same day, then you can't go see the other cities.
It's true. You always end up having it on a weekend, either before or after, whatever is closest to April 6th. And then when we do our reception at Capitol Hill, we have to work around the schedule of Congress, of course. And they are out next week, I think. And they'll be back on the second week of April. So that's why we're doing it after Tartan Day. But we always try to work it around there. But I might add, in Alexandria, when the Irish start celebrating St. Patrick's Day, they start in the first weekend of March, so they celebrate the whole month.
So you say there's like a reception. Is this like a formal reception, like where everyone's like dressed to the nines
or dressed to the kilt?
Dressed to the kilt. We wear our evening dress. That would be it's kind of like a tuxedo jacket, but it's cut away, has some short tails at the back, and we all have our kilts on. Women wear tartan kilts as well. They're long tartan dresses, basically.
Now, is this open to the public, or do you have to buy tickets to it?
It is open to the public because it's held at the Capitol Visitor Center, which is a new facility that's located. It's an underground facility located halfway between the House and the Senate. And yes, it's open to anybody who wants to come.
You said about the last 17 years that it's been celebrated.
Yes.
Have you noticed through your attendance that it's become a bigger and bigger celebration or become more popular?
It has become a bigger and bigger celebration, and one that's taken seriously now. There was a Scottish professor who came over for the very first Tartan Day that we did as a large celebration, I think, in 1999. And he was sort of dismissing the entire connection between the Declaration of Arbroath and the Declaration of Independence. Since that time, however, he has done more research, and he now accepts that there was an influence and that it's a legitimate thing to celebrate. And he's one of our biggest promoters now. We've had, when I... In the early days, in 1999, I decided to organize a festival at in Alexandria. And I just, a year earlier, I just reached out to every member of the Scottish political parties and to the leaders and said, you should send someone to Washington, D.C. for National Tartan Day. Of course, they didn't know what National Tartan Day was. But nevertheless, the Scottish National Party, which is, as you might know, the pro-independence party, they sent a very prominent representative, and the Scottish Conservative Party sent a very prominent representative. And this was in April of 1999. And if you recall back that time, the Scots were preparing to hold an election in May of 1999 for the first Scottish Parliament in, since it was dissolved in 1707, I think, somewhere in that long ago. So it was pretty good that they recognized that. And the Scottish National Party immediately saw this as a way to recruit American support for Scottish independence. And so they were very keen on that. And we had a forum and one day about Scottish independence, even though it was premature by almost 15 years. Now they're going to be holding a referendum, I think, in September on Scottish independence in Scotland. So it has been taken more and more seriously. I can remember early on when I would do radio interviews with BBC Scotland, and the question was always about, aren't we Americans just frivolizing Scottish history? Aren't we pretending that Scotland is all about Brigadoon and stuff? And I would always say to them, you've got the whole thing wrong. If you need to promote your past to promote your future, it's the best way to do that. And Scotland has the most recognizable symbol of any place that I can think of. If you see a man in a kilt with bagpipes, you know that's Scotland. If you see somebody in a kimono, you may not know whether that's a Chinese kimono or a Japanese kimono or a Korean kimono. They're all pretty similar. And I couldn't tell you what America's national dress would be unless it's a cowboy hat and cowboy boots, but most of us don't have cowboy hat and cowboy boots.
And then, even then, it's just a small sliver of a society at a certain time or in a certain time range.
Exactly. And the kilt is still widely worn in Scotland today, usually for Asians. Although the last time my wife and I were in Scotland, which was quite a long time ago, as we were leaving Edinburgh, we saw three or four young Scots men who were dressed in kilts, and they were flying to, I think, to London for a Scottish-English rugby match or something. So they were wearing the kilts, part of what they called their tartan army. So, yeah, and since that time, it's become now pretty much accepted, and the Scots are, I think, embracing their heritage more because of what we're doing. They recently invited Scots worldwide to come to a big festival that they held, I think it was 2 years ago, called The Gathering. And now they're preparing to do a big festival to mark the 400th anniversary of the Battle of, well, it must be longer than that, but the Battle of Bannockburn, which goes back, I think, much farther than 400 years. That was one of the definitive battles where the Scots defeated the English in their wars for independence. So, yeah, they're taking this seriously now, and no longer do I have to explain to Scots about the uniqueness of their own culture.
Now, we've spoken of, or we've asked you about, Tartan Day as you have celebrated it, and as you know, it is celebrated in the U.S. Do you know much about whether or not Tartan Day is celebrated outside of the U.S.?
We know that it's celebrated in Canada. They actually have a Tartan Day celebration as well. And I don't know about other places, because the obvious places would be Australia, New Zealand, and I'm not aware of what's done there. But certainly in Canada, the United States, and now Scotland itself.
So what are your ties to Scotland? I know you said you've been there.
My family ties go back many generations. My Morrisons have been in the United States sometime around the American Revolution. They were part of several waves of Scots who came over in the 17th and 18th century and settled through the Appalachian Mountains and down into the valleys of West Virginia and Virginia and Georgia, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, all of those areas through there. So my heritage goes back quite a ways. I always refer to myself as an American with Scottish heritage, not as a Scot.
Well, that's another thing about, I'm sure, when you spoke to BBC Radio Scotland, is that it's more than just their heritage. For many of us in the United States, it's our heritage.
Well, exactly. There's this, as I referred to, this book by Duncan Bruce called The Mark of the Scots. It was actually written in 1996, so this is before Tartan Day was even devised. But he points out that there are about, at the time of his book, he points out more than 12 million Americans who claim some Scottish heritage, as opposed to about 5 million actual citizens of Scotland. And so you're asking me that the Scottish diaspora is broad and it's great, and Scots often intermarried interracially as well. I was just reading today that the great civil rights leader, Rosa Parks, the one who wouldn't give up her seat on the bus, remember that back in the 1960s? Mm-hmm. So she sort of helped spark the whole freedom rider movement. And she was a black woman, of course, but her great-grandfather was a Scotsman, white Scotsman who had come over as an indentured servant. And there was even an American Indian who became the hereditary clan chief of clan. I want to say McIntosh, but I may be wrong on that one. But it's very interesting. I mean, you'll find people with Scottish heritage who have Italian names, who have German names. You know, there's just Scots went everywhere. They helped found the Russian Navy. It was, obviously, there was a Scotsman, well, Marconi, who in credit with the video of the radio, was actually, his mother, I think, was a Scot. He had Scottish heritage on his mother's side. So you're right, it's everywhere. It is a very widely spread culture. And I was going to tell you that, let's see, what else did I get from his book today? Now we've had, I think President Obama is the 43rd U.S. president, 33 have had some Scottish heritage. I don't know whether President Obama has Scottish heritage. The Scots claim him, but the Irish also claim him through his mother, so I'm not really sure about the current president. But 33 have had some Scottish heritage, and that would include George Washington.
Besides the activities that culminate in the April 6th or thereabout, yes, each year in those celebrations, mm-hmm, what other activities are you yourself and or the National Capital Tartan Day Committee involved in?
The National Tartan Day festivities, which is really the festival, the reception, and then a little bit later, we jointly sponsor what's called a Kirkan of the Tartan. It's a church service at the National Cathedral where people come dressed in their kilts and the clergy blesses the tartan. It's an old ceremony. But we jointly sponsor that with the St. Andrew's Society of Washington. Beyond that, we just plan for the next series of events. We promote it throughout the year. The April Festival, the April Tartan Day Festival in Washington, sort of kicks off a whole season of outdoor Scottish festivals. I mean, not just Washington, of course, but every place it's celebrated. They all kick off this remarkable series of outdoor Scottish festivals and Scottish games, and you could almost go every weekend someplace within a 50-mile drive, 100-mile drive of Washington and go to a Scottish festival of some sort. We in Virginia do the Virginia Scottish Games the first weekend, to Labor Day weekend, that's out near a very beautiful area called Middleburg, which is in the rolling hills of the Piedmont area of Virginia. So yes, it goes on all year round. Tartan Day basically begins and ends, but then once it ends, we start planning again and trying to raise money because it's a very expensive thing to put on. So it does become sort of pretty much like any of these volunteer organizations. It's pretty much a year-round effort to get everything organized.
So we have to ask, are you familiar at all with the Outlander series by Diana Gabaldon?
I am. I've just started reading about it because of our podcast, and really quite fascinated by it. It sounds like it's a great series. I have to get stars and start watching it.
Absolutely. Great plug there. That wasn't even planned. Thank you.
Well, I think that you can definitely expect as the series progresses and begins to actually air that you'll probably see a lot more interest, even more so than you have now, in National Tartan Day perhaps next year.
I think that's absolutely fascinating.
I agree. I think even though the timing is it's not lined up. The National Tartan Day celebrations will have been finished for a bit. We don't know the exact. We have no announcement yet from STARS as to the
premiere date,
but they stick to the same wording they've had for a number of months, many months now, and that is summer 2014.
Okay.
So that could be anywhere from June to August or even September. Yeah, I agree with Summer. I think it'll be very interesting to watch and see, yes, how interested in the books and how much many more copies of the books will sell, but also how many more people might become interested in attending a Highland Games or the following year, a Tartan Day Parade, etc.
Oh, I think everyone's going to start looking at their genealogy to find out if they've got Scottish.
I think they're going to be like, oh, please, oh, please, oh, please. Let me find some Scottish heritage.
You can still wear a tartan, because the little secret is that although in Scotland there are very severe penalties for displaying somebody else's coat of arms, the tartan can be, any tartan pattern can be worn by anybody. Most people don't like to do that if you don't have some clan heritage related to that tartan. Like Morrison has its own very nice red and green, very bright tartan. It's really great at Christmas time. But you could wear the Morrison tartan. You could wear the tartan of Edinburgh. Some of the cities in Scotland have tartans. Or anybody could pretty much wear the Stuart tartan, because that's sort of an interesting story that involves the great Scottish writer Walter Scott. Walter Scott got, I think it was King George IV, to come to Edinburgh for a big celebration of the Scottish heritage, and King wore the Stuart plaid. The Stuart kings had been the king, the House of Stuart followed Queen Elizabeth, and they inherited the throne. They were Scottish kings and inherited the English throne. So George was wearing the Stuart tartan, and he said, all my children can wear this, basically, in which everyone took to mean that anybody like Scottish heritage can throw around Scottish Stuart tartan and wear that. That's a very famous tartan. You would recognize it if you saw it as the tartan that's widely used at Christmas time.
Bringing it back to the tartan, as you just have, you mentioned the dating or the selection of the April 6th date for Tartan Day all over the world, wherever this is celebrated. In a little bit of research that I did, I also saw that there was something called International Tartan Day held on July 1st that recognizes the anniversary of the repeal proclamation that actually repealed the act of prescription, which banned the wearing of the tartan. Do you know much about the act of prescription, or how gutting was it?
I can tell you how that came about. This had to do with the Stuarts. And it had to do with a conflict, a religious conflict, Catholic, Protestant, whether it be High Church Anglican or Presbyterian. There was, this had been going on since Henry VIII broke with the church, and because before that time there was only one church and the rest were dissenters, they were recognized widely. But then when the Stuarts took over, the first one, James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England, professed to be a Protestant. By that time, Protestantism was very firmly rooted in England. But there was always suspicions that he was a secret Catholic. Then when Charles I was beheaded, that again had religious overtones as well as monarchical overreach in his authority as king. He wanted to be an absolute monarch, but Parliament objected, and that led to the English Civil War, which gave you Cromwell, and then the Restoration with Charles II. And then you come to James II. He married a Catholic bride, and the English were shocked and were fearful that this could lead to another Catholic on the throne. So James actually flees England at a particularly tense time, and his son is born. I mean, his son was born in England, but his son becomes, he didn't really inherit, didn't really become James III, but he was called the Old Pretender. That led to William and Mary in England and Britain. But then what happened with, and it's a long way to get to the point of the kilt, but you have to know the background to understand this. James the III's son, Charles Edward, who became Bonnie Prince Charlie, led an uprising in 1745 to try to restore his father, try to restore the Stuarts to the throne. That rebellion actually conquered Scotland, and if he'd stopped there, he probably would have restored the Stuarts to the Scottish throne. But they were moving on to London when his rebellion just sort of petered out. They never got into London, never conquered. They retreated. And in 1746, at the Battle of Culloden, the Scottish Rebellion was put down in a very bloody battle. After that, the king declared that the tartan and bagpipes would be banned as instruments of war, basically. And so that lasted until what the incident you're talking about, the restoration and the repeal of that Prescription Act. What's interesting about the Morrison tartan is that the red tartan that I was telling you about was discovered, I think, in the 1930s in an old house in the Outer Hebrides, which is sort of the ancestral home of the Morrisons. And it was wrapped around a Bible. And inside the Bible, it was there was an inscription that said the Morrison tartan, 1747. So they had hidden that tartan right after the Prescription Act went into effect. And so that's what you're talking about with the repeal of the Prescription Act.
Person living today, hundreds of years after this, is easy to read a history book.
Yeah.
It's easy to speak to someone about it and to think you understand how important this was or how big of a deal this was. But I think it's pretty impossible for us, at least in our with our modern lifestyles and conveniences and relative safety in our communities, etc., to just wrap our heads around how dangerous of a time it was back then.
Yeah, it was basically a Highland culture, because Lowland Scots at that time did not wear the kilt. It was a dress of I want to say it was for an impoverished people, but of course the clan chiefs would dress up spectacularly with rich brocades, coats, and feathers and jewels. But the benefit of the kilt, the original kilt, was that it was just a long piece of material that you would roll yourself up into and throw it over your shoulder, put a belt around it, and if it was a rainy day, you could pull up the excess cloth, put it over your head as a protection from the wind or rain, and in the evening you could just roll it out as a as bedding and sleep on the ground. So it was very practical, and it was frequently all that the Highlanders had, just this one long piece of cloth. What we wear today is more like a skirt, but it's typically about 8 yards of material, very heavy thing to wear, and if you unwrap it, it just goes across your whole living room.
Don't let a Scotsman hear you call it a skirt.
Actually, the word kilt is Gaelic for skirt. And
well then.
Yeah, so it's not really.
So it's fair.
Don't call this skirt. Or at least that's what I've been told. And then the little thing you wear around the waist, that's called a sporran. That's also just another word for purse.
But the
purse wasn't just a distinction of between men and women. You know, everybody carried purses because they didn't have pockets. So it would just be a drawstring thing that they tied around their waist over their belt.
They look like fancy fanny packs.
Yeah. I was surprised the Scots didn't invent the fanny pack. Is what I mean.
Yeah, seriously.
They did. They're just not laying claim to it. Nobody wants to admit to it.
But someone made a lot of money off of that.
One of the great things of Diana's books, besides the fact that she's a wonderful writer, her descriptions of the most mundane thing are just beautiful. But one of the great things is that while she begins in Scotland and the immediate historical period leading up to Culloden, mm-hmm. in the first two books, basically the story moves to the Caribbean and then to the colonies, basically.
Yeah.
And it's in colonial America from, what, book 4 to 7?
Mm-hmm.
And a little bit of travel back and forth, but predominantly set. And so it's so neat to see. Obviously, she's going with the historical record much as possible. So, of course, she's not making up the very general history. But it, again, though myself as a reader, fall in love with these characters and you see them travel through the places I just mentioned,
yep.
It's also nice to take a step back and realize that, yeah, we're looking at the lives of these two and those surrounding them, but how many thousands of people during the clearances or mm-hmm. during whatever period of time migrated
mm-hmm.
and how our population came to be what it was. Could you speak a little bit about the movements of the Scottish people around or just after Culloden?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there was a lot of movement around that time, and there were clearances that the Scots did to themselves, landowners clearing out tenants. And not so different from the troubles that the Irish suffered during the affairs like the potato famine. But that period started to bring a lot more Scots to America, especially during the 17th and 18th century. So that was one of the richnesses that gave the Appalachian region its richness today, because so many of them were Scots or Ulster Scots. Sometimes called Scotch-Irish, but that's not a very good term to describe them, because they weren't Scots and Irish. They were Scots who had originally moved from Scotland to Northern Ireland, province of Ulster, and then on to the United States. But the clearances did increase that flow. Many of many Scots were already here, of course. I'm just reading right now a book about the rivalry between, well, not the rivalry, but the difference between Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton and their different outlooks on the right prescription for an early America. And Hamilton was the son of an itinerant Scotsman in the Caribbean, and he was impoverished, and later he ends up coming to the United States, or to the American colonies at the time, and ending up in New York, where he eventually maintains his fame and fortune. Jefferson, on the other hand, was raised in some luxury. His father owned a plantation, but he was schooled by Scotsmen. And one of his famous tutors was a fellow named William Small, who tutored him and much of his education at William and Mary. So yeah, but between those two, and George Washington actually, when he realized that the key to successful farming was diversity, and he not only started to plant wheat crops and things of that sort, but he also brought a Scotsman over to open a distillery, which is now still operating today. So yeah, they were pretty much everywhere, Scots. As I said, two of the letters, the Declaration of Independence, were Scots. And it's really hard to underestimate the importance of them. And you find Scottish heritage in some of the oddest places. For example, many people would not know, let me see if I can find my book here, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had Scottish heritage. Mostly people think of him as having Dutch heritage. Gracious, I mean, the list goes on and on and on from Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson, and on it goes. So the influence of that particular period of time was great, and these people probably could trace their heritage back to some folks who were dumped in the clearances and had to flee. So there was definitely a great influence in the United States from that period of time.
We have a little bit or a lot about the Tartan Day and the influence of Scots in America, mm-hmm. on our culture and in our history.
That's correct. And they were also some of the biggest industrialists. Andrew Carnegie, for example, was a Scotsman. He was one of those poor folks who came here with no money and somehow ended up running, the steel corporation and making a fortune. Became one of the world's, I guess he was America's richest man at the time. But yes, you have all of that. And today you have so many people who are so talented in playing bagpipes and performing Scottish country dance. As you see, if you see some of that, you'll recognize some of the influence from Scottish country dancing into American folk dancing.
So do you have any recommendations of where someone could find some discounted kilts? Because everywhere I look, they're crazy expensive.
They are crazy expensive. No.
At least you're honest.
They are going to run you probably $400 or possibly more, depending upon what quality you get and what weight of the heavier the weight, the better the kilt, because it holds its pleats better. It's possible to buy the material and make it yourself. It's the only difficulty in kilt making. One reason it gets so expensive is because if you look at the back of a kilt, although it may have multiple folds, the pattern is folded in such a way to reproduce the pattern on the front side of the kilt. So in other words, they take all this material, fold it in such a way that when you look at it, it doesn't look like it's pleat, it just looks like the pattern. There are other ways to do it, of course, that gets complicated, but you can just fold it. You can wear the kilt the way the original people did, which was just great big piece of material, and you basically lie down in it and wrap one part over you, another part over you, put a belt around it, and all the material you just push to the back, and it sort of forms natural pleats. Pull the rest up over your shoulder, put a brooch around it, and off you go. And that's the original. That was the original kilt. But no, I can't think of any. I mean, people have been able to find kilts on places like eBay. If you could find your size, that's always difficult to do, because kilts are so customized. They for a man, the kilt should be worn at his waist and down to like the middle of his knee. You see a lot of Americans, a lot of men wearing their kilts much too long, and that's just a badly measured kilt. So it's difficult to buy it online unless you have a way you could return it if it doesn't fit. A kilt can be very forgiving, but after you gain too much weight, you just can't.
So inadvertently shorter, more.
There's a scene in Outlander, and I'm not sure if you've gotten to it yet, where a certain male character, one of the leads, quickly gets dressed and quickly puts his kilt on, yep. And then goes on to do whatever he does. And a number of fans, including Summer and myself, have kind of speculated, is that even possible? Can you put a kilt on that quickly?
Well, not the modern kilt, because that requires buckles and everything. But yes, I assume since we're talking about the period of time we're talking about, that would be the ancient kilt. And that would again be just one giant piece of material. It's hard to even give you an idea of the thing you're talking about. It would be any length that would be wide enough to wrap around you, and the depth would have to be enough where you could pull the excess material up over your head for bad weather. But yeah, all you have to do is just lie on the ground, pull it two flaps over you, basically what you would have, you would put on first, put the material on top of the belt, lie down on it, pull the both flaps over, tighten the belt, and stand up. And then you pull the rest of the stuff around. You always have a lot of stuff left over on the back, and you just pull that over your shoulder or pull it around you like a cape. You could do that because what else do you have? You'd be the shirt you would be wearing would be the shirt that you probably slept in, like a big night shirt, which would have long tails. And all you had left to do was, I guess, you put your socks on, your shoes, and off you go. So, yes, I think it is possible to do that.
Okay, good. So Diana was right.
I think she was. Would be surprised if she tried it.
I mean, I'm sure he could put it on quickly. It might just be a little more disheveled.
Well, it would be disheveled. I mean, the old kilt is not as well designed as the current thing is because, the pleats are very specific and the pleats are sewn in. Whereas the old kilt, pleats is nothing more than what the extra material that you've gathered behind you.
Pleats that are arranged because of the way you put it on.
Because of the way you folded the material behind you.
Okay.
And it's basically, if you ever put a belt on and your trousers are a little bit too large and you're pushing the material back, same principle. Mm-hmm. But yeah, basically, I mean, the old kilt can look really good, but it's a very, very basic, simple method of dressing.
Do you have an old style kilt, or
I have the modern kilt, the skirt kilt. Yeah.
How many kilts do you have?
Oh, just one. Just one.
Just one good one. That's all.
That's all I need.
I've read that there are different. I don't know if it's all historically accurate, but I know at least currently, if you go to a Highland Games or a kilt shop. I don't think I've been to a kilt shop outside of Scotland, but at various Highland Games, they'll have at least one or two tents that have a decent selection of tartan. And I've seen, like, the Mackenzie, you'll see, or the Gordon, whatever. You'll have the dress, you'll have the hunting, you'll have the this, the that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that historically accurate, that they would have the different type?
Probably not. I think that's a merchandising thing that sort of came about over the past 100 years or maybe longer, probably like Victorian period of time. What was interesting about when you raised the issue about the repeal of the prescription law, by the time that Sir Walter Scott, see, you're talking about 1746, and by the time that Walter Scott takes the king to Edinburgh for a big celebration, that's like 1820, I think, around that period of time. So during that period, most of the Scottish Highland chiefs who would have been wearing the kilt or even prominent people in the lowlands who never wore a kilt had put them away, forgotten about them, maybe destroyed them. So there was a bad dash, all the Edinburgh tailors, for any kind of tartan that you could find to make a kilt for to attend the king's reception. So a lot of kilts can date no farther back than that particular period. And so some of the family names associated with kilts go back about that far. We're fortunate with the Morrisons to have it go back a little bit farther in historical. Basically, there are hunting kilts, presumably to, I don't know, so the animals won't see you. I thought most animals are colorblind, so that wouldn't make that much difference anyways. But I think it's mostly just another merchandising aspect. They all look very good. I mean, the hunting kilts are quite nice, and that might be the kilt that you might wear on going out to some of these outdoor games because they wouldn't get, if they got dirty, they wouldn't show bad because mostly they're of a earthy kind of a colors. But there are some clans that have 20 or different patterns. Ours just has two, basically. There's a green kilt and a red kilt, and then variations of those two, which are called ancient green and modern green. It's just a way to make one kilt look like it's done with vegetable dye. They're basically just two kilts for the Morrisons. But you're right, the Stuarts have a multitude of kilts, and you'll see a lot of that as well. And there will be dress kilts. The Stuarts, they have the popular red dress kilt. They have a white dress, I think, and a black Stuart, which is really a very pretty, very handsome arrangement of colors. That's about all I can tell you about that. They don't go way back, and there were stories about the Battle of Culloden where there would be confusion in the battle because you had the Scottish rebels on one side, Highlanders mostly, who would be wearing kilts, and on the other side you had Scots who were loyal to the crown wearing kilts, and English soldiers who be wearing a different uniform. But in the melee, there is at least several times recorded that one Scotsman almost killed an ally because his ally had lost his bonnet, and that usually had some kind of a symbol on it. And so it wasn't the kilt that was distinctive, it was something else. So apparently that suggests that the kilt historically was not widely associated with a particular clan. They may have been associated in the sense that there were kilt makers in certain regions of Scotland where they would have a certain type of threads, certain colors that they would make, and then they became associated with the families. But it really doesn't matter. I think it's great to have them associated with your clan. And there are some really remarkable kilts out there. One of my favorites is one that's black and yellow with the red stripe through it. It's really dashing kilt. You do find a lot of different patterns, not necessarily always historically associated with a clan name.
Well, you mentioned modern made tartans, meaning made so that they appear to be made by vegetable dye?
Yes, some of them. Like with the Morrison, we have a bright red and then what's called the ancient kilt, which is of a more faded color. So they look more like an orange color than a red. And then we have one that is a green, which is a very distinctive green and blue pattern. But when it's worn in the ancient, it looks more pastels. That's basically the difference. And it's just a fashion, a marketing thing.
There is not one thing that Summer and I have seen at every turn of a glimpse that Stars has given us into this production, whether it's a glimpse of the characters, a picture of the tartan that they had made for the show.
Ah.
It's beautiful, and of course, we're longtime fans. One of the things that I find so interesting and beautiful is that the tartan that they had made specifically for the show is very muted.
Ah.
And from what I understand, Terry Moore, Ron D. Moore's wife, who is head of costuming for the show, mm-hmm. she talked about their process and how they specifically looked for roots, herbs,
mm-hmm.
plants
mm-hmm.
that would have been available at the time
mm-hmm.
that or around the time that would have been used to dye, and then what colors would they have been, even if they aren't being used today for that.
That's right.
To make their tartan for the show.
Mm-hmm.
She wanted it to be, my word is muted, that's not her language,
mm-hmm.
but she didn't want it to necessarily be, you know, this really bright, flashy thing.
Right.
More, it seems, as you're saying, it is potentially more authentic, at least, if not in color, in tradition to the period.
Because that would have been where the colors would have come from. That would have given you, oh, I suppose indigo gives you a nice dark blue, but I suppose most of them would be sort of a muted or earth tones or faded looking. Yeah, that would be about right, I think. And are these characters wearing the old kilt? Old style kilt is called the great kilt. So are they wearing that, or are they wearing just the skirt in the?
From what we've seen, it's the great kilt. It's one piece that goes up around them and up over their shoulders.
That is historically accurate. Yep, that's really
awesome.
Cool. Yeah,
that's what they've done. I mean, just from what we've read and the pictures that we encourage you to go take a look at pretty much any of the fan sites has every single photo. But if you go to the Outlander Stars Facebook group, they post all of the official photos there, as well as they're on Instagram. If for no other reason than to look at the tartan, it is beautiful.
I will do that. I will do that. If you look at the Braveheart movie, I don't know if you've seen that.
Yes, yeah. Of course.
Well, William Wallace would not have worn a kilt. He was a Lowland Scot, and he would have worn tights and chainmail. In fact, there's if you've been to Scotland, I think it's in Edinburgh, maybe it's someplace else, maybe it's in Stirling, there is a statue to William Wallace, I think, and you see him dressed like that. Robert the Bruce also, he wouldn't have worn a kilt. They would have worn more medieval type of dresses, standard stuff that you would see. However, there's another movie that I like much better. I think it's called Rob Roy, and it's the fictional character Rob Roy MacGregor. It opens with a group of Scotsmen clambering over Highland glens, and they're all wearing the great kilt, and it's very authentic looking, and they look right. And it's much more interesting film, I think.
Yes, I think that's Liam Neeson
and Jessica Lange. Exactly, yeah.
I love that film.
Yeah.
I believe I saw those two movies in the same
week. I think they both came out in 1995. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it was 95. They came out very shortly after each other, and I saw them in the theaters. I think I saw Braveheart first, and then I saw Rob Roy shortly thereafter.
Braveheart overtook Rob Roy as the film.
Sure.
And nobody remembers Rob Roy. I don't think it's...
Unless you're a Scottophile.
Or a Liam Neeson fan.
Or a Liam Neeson fan. Then you will.
Well, I remember one of the clan tents, the Wallace clan tent at one of the Virginia Scottish Games, where they had this poster for Braveheart and a list of all the inaccuracies in the film.
Oh, no.
Great historical...
Was it embarrassing?
Oh, pretty much so.
Oh my goodness.
They didn't like the portrayal because, you know, they're honest clan and they're historical and everything. But that gave me the idea that when we set up our Morrison clan tent, that we have a cardboard cutout of John Wayne, whose real name was Marion Michael Morrison. We have this great collection of Morrisons who were actors or serial killers in some cases.
Oh my goodness.
at least one.
Well, I guess if you're going to mention one of them, you got to mention all
of
them.
We got to mention all of them.
The good with the bad.
they're good, bad, but no ugly Morrisons. Surprised you didn't ask me what a Scotsman wears under his kilt.
We don't want to embarrass ourselves because everybody asks that and we're embarrassed by that.
Well, the simple response is shoes.
Right. Oh, I've never heard that one before.
That leaves everything to the imagination.
Exactly. That's very good.
So if somebody wanted to find out more about Tartan Day or your committee, where would they go to find that?
They could go to our website, which is dctartanday.com, and that's just all one word, dctartanday.com. It's TartanDay.com. And that pretty much, we're just building that website, and we have a very good webmaster who's working on it. I think he's got some good stuff up there, and some good explanations about Tartan Day and the Tartan Day Committee.
We have that, and if someone wanted to get in touch with you, is that website also the best way, with yourself or the committee?
Yes, that would be the best way. I think there's an email contact on that website.
Okay, great. Perfect.
Yeah, cool. But they could email me. My personal email is James Ellis Morrison, that's would be James, middle name Ellis, and Morrison, Morris, is James Ellis Morrison at gmail.com.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Morrison. And,
well, I thank you. It's great fun to do this.
It is. All of our guests, we love having them on, and they all, because of the theme of our podcast, obviously they're all somehow connected to the books or Scotland. But this is neat because it's an American connection.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
So once again, we'd like to thank Mr. Morrison for joining us this week. It was a great, fun interview we had with him.
Always fun to have people on to chat with. And we are always educated in whatever we are discussing. We learn a lot. So thank you again for joining us. We look forward to our next episode.
We'll be rejoining our read-along next week with Chapter 26, The Laird's Return, which is the beginning of Part 5, entitled
Lallybroch. Oh, yeah. Count Ian. We're going to Ian.
What? We're going to Ian? Is it a verb now?
I don't know.
Anyway, please read and join us next week.
Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/outlanderpod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.
Dreamt it last night that my young